On January 25th of this year, the Office of Price Stabilization issued its first ceiling price regulation. The general price freeze, which held prices on all commodities at their January levels. In the intervening period to date, OPS has issued a number of other price orders which establish ceiling price formulas in particular industries or levels of trade. Over these 6 months, OPS officials have constantly reiterated the fact that the initial OPS price regulations were to be of an interim nature and would later be replaced by orders which set specific dollar and cent ceiling prices on most of the commodities which you buy at your local stores. Explaining the need for interim regulations, OPS said that a person couldn't stop a speeding automobile by simply jamming on the brakes. If this happened, chances were that the automobile would go out of control and might possibly be wrecked beyond compare. Applying this analogy to the economics of the nation, OPS said that before it could establish firm dollar and cent ceilings, it must first hold the price line by preventing prices from going any higher. This, they said, was the job of interim formula regulations, to simply hold the price line. According to the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics price index, the interim orders have done their job. Prices over the past 6 months have tended not only to level off, but also in some instances to show slight declines. This being true, OPS feels the time has now come for an examination of circumstances and the possible setting of firm dollar and cent ceiling prices on a community basis. Those of you who can remember the not-too-distant days of OPA may recall that the most successful form of price control during the recent war was based on the so-called community pricing system. And community pricing means nothing more or less than dividing the country into relatively small market areas and establishing dollar and cent ceiling prices in these areas, taking into account the cost of local transportation and other cost factors. Additionally, as an aid to consumers and retailers alike, community pricing calls for the posting in retail stores of price charts which show at a glance the top legal price which can be charged for any item in a given area. This, then, is what community pricing is, and I am talking about it now because of the item current in this week's news, which says that OPS has announced a program leading to the establishment of community pricing in grocery stores throughout the nation. According to this item, James G. Lyons, OPS Regional Director for New York and New Jersey, has announced that surveys of retail and wholesale food establishments will be started at the end of this month. The purpose of the surveys, which will involve over 2,000 retail and more than 1,000 wholesale establishments, will be to determine sample community prices on a wide number of commodities sold by your local grocer. These sample community prices will be compared with existing ceiling prices and with actual selling prices. One of the principal purposes of the survey will be to discover whether there is sufficient stability in prices of a number of standard grocery items to make a community pricing program possible. Michael V. DeSalle, National OPS Director, points out that the community pricing program was considered to be the most successful, most important, and most effective of all OPA programs during World War II. This program, he said, made available exact dollar and cent ceilings both to consumer and food retailers. The program had a lot to do in holding the line on wholesale and retail food prices from the time it was started in 1943 through the end of the price control program. OPS is fully aware, Mr. DeSalle continued, of the important part that a community pricing program can play in the stabilization program, of the necessity for having published ceilings for consumers, and of the great help such a program can be to individual grocers in simplifying their pricing program. Thus far, the agency is prohibited by law from controlling below parity farm prices. It has not had sufficient assurance the prices have been stable enough to make the printing and posting of ceiling charts practicable. The process of preparing and printing a chart, Mr. DeSalle said, takes a certain minimum amount of time. Obviously, you can't do it successfully if prices change so rapidly that a chart is out of date almost from the moment it goes up in the stores. You've got to be sure of a reasonable degree of price stability before you can start. Therefore, before inaugurating a nationwide program as important as community food pricing, it is necessary that we obtain the specific information about food prices needed to assure the program's success. Well, that's what Mr. DeSalle has to say about community pricing, what it is, why we haven't had it to date, and what we all hope it can do when it goes into effect. When you consider the subject of inflation, you are contemplating something that finds its way into every home and household in the nation. No one escapes. For inflation, like the exhilaration that comes from any stimulant, always has a corresponding reaction. In a way, inflation is comparable to the experience of the person who goes on a week-long bender. He feels fine while it is in progress, but the next few days after he comes to his senses are not enviable ones. The Depression of 1929 and the years thereafter, which few of us will forget, were a sterling example of what is meant. In the years between 1921 and 1929, this nation experienced a great wave of pseudo-prosperity. Prices of all commodities went up and up. Money piled up in the stock market. Learned economists were forecasting that this could go on forever and ever. But the learned economists had overlooked one thing. The dollar, then as now, was the standard money of the world. Foreign countries were eager to get their hands on more and more dollars. So as prices mounted here, these foreign countries found it profitable to send their manufactured goods to the United States. Even in spite of the tariff walls that then existed, other nations could send us their textiles, their steel, even their foodstuffs and gain higher returns, all of which cut down the market for our domestic products. The finishing touch, of course, came when our farms and our industrial enterprises became glutted with commodities and products for which they could find no markets. Moreover, because of our high prices, we could not export. South America, Europe, and China, which had been dependent on us for many things, found they could buy them cheaper elsewhere. So they did exactly that, with the result that in 1929 and for almost 10 years thereafter, we were faced with a surplus of foodstuffs and with an overplus of manufacturing facilities for which there was insufficient domestic demand and practically no market abroad. Hardest hit were the United States farmer and, presently, the United States cattle grower. Farm products, for example, are grown everywhere in the world. The standard crop, that which sets the prices for most all farm crops, is wheat. Yet a crop of wheat is garnered every day in the year, for wheat grows from within 2 degrees of the Arctic Circle to within 2 degrees of the Antarctic Circle. The major areas which provide most of the world's wheat are the United States, Canada, Australia, South America, India. There is, of course, another great center of wheat surplus, the Ukraine in Russia. But that part of the world is too busy nowadays meeting its own needs to have much of any exportable surplus. It was the farmer and the cattle grower of the United States whose difficulties led us into the devastating deflation of the 1930s. These farmers and cattle growers were the ones who really hit the depths. The farmer found himself overloaded with wheat and other grain stuffs which had no markets. On the other hand, the banks, who had granted him heavy mortgages on farm properties, were demanding payments. In order to meet these mortgage payments, the farmers did what they could. They began selling their dairy cattle for their beef values in the packing centers. This move broke the prices for beef for the southwestern cattle growers, who in turn had to throw thousands more head of cattle on the market in the face of rapidly falling prices to meet the loans on their banks. And so it went. With the farmers and the cattle growers in distress, the railroads in that part of the nation lacked haulage. The farmers and cattle growers had no money to buy manufactured products, so freight trains were running empty. The railroads, in turn, could not buy cars or rails or other steel products. Well, you can easily see how the nation gradually and inevitably slid into a major depression. And you can see also that it was the impoverishment of the United States farmer that led the way downward. It is an old axiom that if the most fundamental of all undertakings, the providing of food, is unprofitable, then everything else must be unprofitable also. For every person in the world must eat every day in order to maintain health or even life itself. People can live in caves or burrows if they must. They can make clothing out of leaves, but they have to eat above all else. So that the providing of food has always been the basic undertaking of every economy. Today, in the 20 years since the Depression started, we have taken definite and very wise steps toward preventing such another tragedy. Farm prices have been established so that the farmer probably will not again be the leader in a downward movement. That is one of the wisest pieces of legislation ever put on the books. On the other hand, however, we must not let prices for food or other essentials get out of hand, for inflation always takes its eventual toll. Joseph, in the Bible, he of the coat of many colors, was the first recorded economist. He warned Pharaoh that the fat years would inevitably be followed by the seven lean years. Had Pharaoh established price stabilization, the fat years might not have been as fat for some. But the lean years would not have been so devastatingly lean for the many. Community pricing is another tested weapon which may be thrown into the battle against inflation. But in the final analysis, neither community pricing or any other anti-inflation weapon is going to win the battle alone. Most importantly, nothing will win this battle without your constant help. You are the infantry, in effect. And while the other branches of the service can weaken the enemy, it is usually the infantry that actually does the mopping up job. Several weeks ago, I told you how you can help. I told you that the method by which you could help was deceptively simple. And now I repeat that while it may be simple, it is also tremendously effective. Just remember, buy only what you need when you need it. And whatever you buy, whenever you buy, buy wisely. Another way you can help fight inflation is by educating yourself and your neighbors as to what inflation really is and what its horrifying effects can be. The Office of Price Stabilization has district offices in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, and New York in New York State, and in Trenton and Newark, New Jersey. All of these district OPS offices are staffed with friendly people whose job it is to help you. If you have any questions on OPS price control, policies, or questions on inflation, I too will be happy to help you find the answers. Just write your question on a postcard or in a letter and address it to me, Schuyler Patterson, OPS, 2 Park Avenue, New York City. The address again is OPS, 2 Park Avenue, New York City. And this is Schuyler Patterson saying goodbye until next week at the same time over these same stations. Good night.